Accession number 23222, room 5.
Sir William Bolton, room 5. In your journal and letters during the siege of Tobruk, you mentioned that a lot of the time nothing much was happening and there was quite a lot of boredom in the garrison.
Yeah.
And there was some disappointment after an attempt at relief had failed to break
well, yeah,
in.
Yeah, well, the morale went down like a,
yes.
a bomb. Because we'd all, you know, I think 6 months had gone, or four, several months had gone by, and we knew that an attack was coming to relieve us, and of course the news was awful.
Was there anything you could do to try and improve morale and to sustain it?
I don't know that one could do much. I mean, all one can say is we know there will be another one in due course, but we've just got to go on as we've been doing it.
Now, you were in a position to observe both your own gunners in the yeomanry and the Australians. Would you say that one part or the other were more affected by this disappointment and
well,
boredom?
I think the Australians, I can't quite remember. Well, it was only shortly after that that they went out. There's a very remarkable evacuation because it all had to be done by our destroyers at night, a whole division, or practically a whole division. So they really didn't affect them an awful lot because they were replaced partly by British and partly by Polish troops.
How did the Poles and British cope with the tedium of being involved in a prolonged siege?
All I can say is up to the time that I finally went out, everything seemed to be all right. But we were a bit worried about the Poles because we were limited to ammunition. And they were told they could only fire 70 rounds of gun a day unless there was an emergency. And they went and shot off practically everything within a day, two or three days, which wasn't very popular because it was extremely difficult keeping up supplies. But otherwise, I had no complaint. I think the Poles excelled themselves in the war. And I can't remember, because I wasn't there, how much part they took in the breakout.
They had a reputation of always being very aggressive.
Yes. There wasn't all that opportunity because, when they came in, as you say, there was a period, I think, comparatively quiet. And as far as we were concerned, there used to be a certain amount you could see in the distance travelling and could shoot at, but there was no sort of... The big attacks had happened, I think, before then, you see, when the Australians were still there.
When morale did start to deteriorate, what were the signs that you saw, that you detected?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't want to expect, a lot of depressing talk and so on, but I had to be a bit careful going around saying, oh God, are we ever going to get out, that sort of thing. But my recollection is that there's these chaps, they were very calm types, they'd seen a certain amount, they'd been in Tobruk some months, and I think they very quickly got used to it. I can't remember anything that was critical or crisis.
So no deterioration in discipline?
None at all.
Because that frequently follows.
I can't remember a single incident of that.
As if morale sinks to a certain point, discipline starts.
I think that certainly must happen. It didn't happen here.
You mentioned also the salient in the southwest corner.
Yes.
Could you tell me what that was like to be in?
Well, I can't tell you because we were on the east side.
Yes.
And one of our batteries, or part of one, was taken down there to supplement what was there already. But I never went down there at that time. And it must have been pretty awful. The first time the Germans, they were chucked back again. I think most of their tanks went over mines. But the second time, they came in, they were never, in fact, entirely pushed out. And it was rather like, I think, the First World War in that particular part, that there were trenches and the forces were only 200 or 300 yards apart at the most. And anybody who stuck their head up in daylight was stupid because he'd probably get a bullet in his head. But, I mean, thank goodness I wasn't there because I'm sure it was very unpleasant.
You mentioned also that the Germans dropped leaflets. Yes, on the Australians. Did those have any visible impact?
Did you see one in my diary?
Yes, indeed.
No, it was just a jolly good joke. The Bats of Tobruk, you see, we got the name and it's stuck ever since. So anybody, I think the Duchess is getting awful. What is she going to want to go?
You also discussed various observation posts.
Yes.
What were the ones that you thought were best? Were they the ladder ones or were they the ground level ones?
Well, the ladder ones, because for anything at ground level, you really couldn't see very much. And I mean, I think the best ones were the one or two built by the Italians, which were higher, I think, than anything the Australians put up, and easy to get up and down. We more or less we made more use of them because, as I say, the only places where you could really see a distance.
You're also saying that generally the visibility was poor and that there were only certain hours of the day when you could count on being able to see things.
That's right, because as the sun grew up, it all got very hazy. I can remember an awful moment one time when I was up there doing a stint and I went to sleep and I suddenly woke up and got the impression that the attack was right in front of us. I don't know why, but there was perhaps some noise from somewhere. And I suddenly realised it was just a haze, I couldn't see much, and just woken up with a start.
Did you suffer from the mirage effect? Did you sometimes see things that weren't there?
Yes, there was a bit of it, I think. But I can't remember any thoughts of something that, was really any trouble or a nuisance.
You also said you had two really good shoots. One of them, a counter-battery shoot, where you had a section of guns firing on an enemy battery that was out in the open. Do you have any idea roughly how far away the enemy battery was?
I think, probably anything between 1 and 2 miles, I think. It was an unusual situation because one didn't really get a chance of seeing artillery because they were a long way away and not within normal view. But on this particular morning, which was a fine morning, there suddenly four gun flashes, which was the first time I think I'd ever seen it. Well, of course, once you saw those, you could start ranging on them. And having range, one could, as I say, we only had a couple of guns up close by for that time of day. And I don't know, we must have done quite a bit of damage because there were several explosions there.
Do you know what sort of guns they were?
The Italians, they had two. One was a field gun of about, a bit, I think, less than a 25-pound. The other was about a 6-inch How, I think. They were both a lot of those guns, which we, of course, captured and the Australians used, or we used one or two of them.
I was going to ask you about your Italian artillery. You mentioned you had a couple of 149mm guns and some 75mm anti-aircraft guns.
Yes. I think we had a couple. Mm. And we used them, partly because they had a greater range than anything we had. And I remember it was the only thing we had in the regiment would reach a ladder where the enemy were. There was an airfield there, and they had quite a few. It was sort of defended position, I think. But the other thing was that they used to have a bang at some of these bombers that were flying over. They never actually hit one, but I think they made them keep up a bit.
What did you think of these guns as pieces of equipment, their design and their operating characteristics? Do you think they were well designed and good weapons?
No, we had to be jolly careful because there were one or two lives lost, including one, I think, an officer in the 1st RHA next to us. I think the dangerous ones were the 6-inch howl because the fault may have been in the ammunition, not the gun. The other thing was, I told you last time that there was something funny about the Italian fuses, because as a rule, they hit the ground, went in and made a hole in the ground, and it didn't spread much, which was a good thing from our point of view.
So the fuses weren't very sensitive then?
No, they must somehow have been delayed a bit.
What about actually operating the guns, doing the gun drill on these Italian pieces? Was that
well? The 6-inch howl. After there'd been one or two of these blowbacks, we only fired them with had a rope on and got right by well behind before we pulled the rope. I don't think we didn't have any of the 75mm things you're talking about. The Australians had all those.
But I mean, were they efficient as pieces of artillery if they'd been in good condition?
Nothing wrong with them at all, I think. Of course, they hadn't got these gun sights where you could get an exact direction on them. Those weren't there. They'd gone. So it was purely a sort of open sights point of view from. Except the 6-inch howls, we could, because of our own equipment, we could direct them as we wanted.
But this was improvisation, wasn't it, really?
Yes, very much so. Yes. But it did play an important part.
Yes. And you were saying that the Australians actually drove off an attack by the panzers at one stage using this.
Yes, I noticed that I did, put that in the diary. I can't remember the exact details of that.
You call it bush artillery, I think.
That's right.
Yes. And you mentioned also that you liked particularly the eastern sector because there the country was more interesting, it was more broken, and you could see more. There were wadis.
That's right,
I
down toward near the sea.
Yes. Did you manage to get over that way frequently, or was that just an occasional?
No, well, I mean, our OPs, I think we had an OP that could look, of course, you could only sort of see anything in, as I say, in the certain hours before there was any haze and so on. But there was somebody there that I know who, was always there at dawn and onwards from there. Of course, I think the danger of an attack there was unlikely because of the broken country. It was going to be difficult to come up and down across a lot of wadis.
But also make good hiding places, wouldn't it, for infantry forming up?
That's right, they could stick stuff there.
Yeah.
And one of the things was, especially the, not only us, but the Australians made a lot of it, because they had difficulty, and if anything they were asked to shoot at, which they couldn't see properly, well, what they used to do was to shoot and cock the gun up or down slightly until they heard a big rumble, which meant that the thing had gone down one of the wadis.
That's very practical gunnery, isn't it?
Very practical, yes.
Did you do...
But I think it was an important part of the American morale, the Australian morale.
Did you do any speculative shooting into such places that might have been forming up points or dumps?
I can't remember doing that. I told you that we did keep shooting at night to try and stop their gun shooting at the harbour.
Yes.
And that was, of course, able to calculate from their gun flashes.
How would you do that? Would you use two OPs to get two bearings?
And yes.
It would be trigonometry then.
Yes. But I couldn't know how to do it now, but it was comparatively simple at that time. You know exactly how you did it.
Were you able to keep a detailed artillery board?
No, I don't remember that.
And you were saying that at one point you got jaundice, and a lot of officers got jaundice.
That's right.
Have you any idea of why that was and how
well,
it was transmitted?
Well, it's a very interesting point, because the officer, about 30 or more percent of the officers got it, and the other ranks hardly got it at all. And it misfired. I came across a fellow who had served in the army headquarters at Cairo, I think on the sort of medical side, and he said that this jaundice was due to the local water, which was in these deep wells and rather brackish. And the inference was that the officers had got far more water than the other ranks. Well, I don't think this was true, not to my knowledge anyway. That's the only explanation that I ever got about that.
What happened to you when you got it?
Well, you went to, I think, you went to this hospital in the, what was the town or village on by the sea, and you were there, well, in my case, for two or three nights, until it was known there was going to be room for you on a destroyer going out. And the night before that, or earlier in the evening, you were transferred from the hospital to the harbour, where there was a great cave there in which everybody and anything waiting for a destroyer could take cover. And that happened to me twice, once when I got jaundice, and the other time after I'd gone over a mine and injured my leg.
So where you got out of Tobruk then with the jaundice? You were evacuated?
Yes.
Where did you go when you were evacuated?
Well, it was in Alexandria. And I think a hospital in the canal zone.
What treatment did they give you?
I haven't the slightest idea.
What happened when it was over? Did you manage to get back?
Well, I did, yes. Well, I suppose I was away for about a fortnight, and I was fully entitled to some convalescence leave and so on, but I'd become battery commander a month or two before that, and I had a very strong, of course, a natural inclination to try and get back there. And it wasn't as easy as that, because Tobruk wasn't a very happy place to go to if you wanted to. And the other thing was, again, whether there was space on anything going. But anyway, it was, I think, a fortnight or just over that I went back. And I remember getting an awful rocket on the destroyer, because the captain said everybody got to keep their heads down, because a bomber began to drop bombs, not very close, but about. And I went and put my head up to see what was going on, and got a frightful rocket.
What happened when you got back to the regiment after you'd been?
Well, this, I mean, to some extent, I'm a bit worried about anything that might be published about this, with mine, especially with my name on it, because I found that an officer from the other batteries had taken over my position on a permanent basis. And that wasn't the sort of thing that happened in the Essex Yeomanry, who didn't know an awful lot about army regulations. And I was posted in his place back to the other battery. And I made a fuss about this to the CO, and eventually appealed from him to the brigadier in charge of artillery there, but of course I didn't get anywhere. But the result was, various results of that. One was that, much later, that when I tried to rejoin the regiment, obviously the CAE wouldn't have me back. And the other thing was that I avoided going to Burma, because the battery to which I was transferred, only a matter of a week or two after the relief of Tobruk, was sent to Burma, just the time that Japanese were arriving at Rangoon, and they had the most awful time getting back to India. We only had a very small force there, and thank God I wasn't there. It really sounds absolutely frightful. And the final, most important of all, if that had happened, I wouldn't have met Elizabeth in Cairo.
Fortunes of war.
Yes.
But I think you were injured again, weren't you? You were injured on a mine. How did that happen?
Well, it's really my fault, and it's connected what I've been telling you, because there were masses of mines that had been laid by the Italians and then by us. And in the first part, until what I told you happened, I was fully aware of all the mines in our battery area. But when I turned over, I wasn't so much knowledgeable about the mines where the other battery was. And it was, I think I was going up to an MP there, an OP, and one of the wheels of my truck went over this mine. And, I mean, it was stupid, because I ought to have made more careful inquiries about exactly where they were. And several other people had done the same thing, and our CO, who I never got on with very well, he said the next person that did that would be put on charge of self-inflicted wound.
Did that happen to you?
Didn't happen to me. But I wouldn't want that to be in any record that's going to be seen by others. At least not my name, anyhow.
What was the immediate effect of the mine on you and the truck then when you went over it?
Well, the truck, one wheel was blown to bits, I think. But inside, it was still there. Fortunately, it was an Egyptian-made mine rather than a German one. In which case I wouldn't have been here. But I know the trouble was that it was very painful getting my boot or shoe off. And once that had been done, there was no difficulty getting back to the hospital, where I went through the same procedure as I told you about for the jaundice. The only trouble about that at the hospital down there, it got bombed every night. And people who were sort of ran the hospital and so on, they all got bomb happy. And when they heard the planes coming, they all went and nosedived into trenches and wretched patients. I mean, all they could do was, if they were mobile enough, was to get under beds. But that was one of the sort of low points of being in that hospital.
How long did it take you to recover from that injury? Altogether?
I don't know. I think it was a sort of, a couple of months, something like that. And then, as I say, I tried to get back to the regiment. The CO wouldn't have me back. And so I had a couple of stars. I think I told you something about this before. I joined the JAG for a short time, and the most interesting part of that was that I had to defend a German prisoner accused of espionage and wearing the uniform of the enemy. I think I mentioned that, didn't I?
No, you didn't. That would be very interesting. How did that turn out?
Well, this must have been about January 42, something like that. It was when we first, Tobruk was relieved and the Germans were pushed right back. And during that time, a German, well, he was said to be an officer, was found in a cave near Derna with a lot of Arabs sitting in the cave wearing an RAF uniform. And so he was arrested. And it took a long time for the full history of that to come out, because it transpired that he'd been caught four or five times trying to get back to German lines, and each time wearing a British uniform, sometimes Army, sometimes RAF, which showed there was a lot of sort of secret places in Libya there, presumably Italians, who were helping Germans if they, opportunity arose. And I think at one occasion he got within 100 yards or two of German lines. But anyhow, because of all these escapes, it became so sort of an issue that at least half a platoon was there after sole occupation was looking after this fellow and seeing he didn't escape again.
Did he speak English?
No.
How did you
communicate? Walter Hadamshek, I remember the name, and my memory is so bad yet that stands.
Yes.
But he wasn't an officer, he was a sergeant in a German tank regiment.
How did you communicate with him? Did you speak German to
him? There must have been an interpreter there, but I that doesn't ring a bell, really.
What could you say in defence of this man?
difficult to say. It couldn't have been more than that he'd picked up a uniform somewhere on the ground from some wounded or dead officer personnel. It wasn't espionage, it was purely trying to get back to the German lines.
Is that the story he told?
To my best of my belief. There was an awkward thing because in actual fact, in the course of one of these escapes, he'd shot up an Indian truck with an officer and another rank in it, killed them and obviously taken their uniforms, but he wasn't charged with that. That, I think, for some technical legal reason.
How did the court-martial go when it came to trial?
Well, I think it lasted more than one day, maybe a couple of days, and he was found guilty on both charges and sentenced to be executed. Well, then the only thing I could do then was to write something as it couldn't be tried as an appeal, but what do you do when you...
Mitigation?
Yes. Mm. And I can't believe that could have had an awful effect, but in actual fact, the sentence was commuted and he was sent off to Australia as a prisoner.
It sounds as though he was very lucky.
Very lucky, I think, indeed.
Mm. What sort of man was he? Did you get an impression?
A tiny little man, about 5'4". Mm. What? And I can't remember anything. There was nothing exciting about him or anything. He was fairly normal.
What was his demeanour during the trial and
proceedings? I think silence as long as he could. Well, then most of my work with JAG was actually prosecuting people. Mm. Being an instructor of the Egyptian army in anti-tank warfare.
When you were prosecuting, what were the main offences that were
being? Desertion.
Desertion. Was there a high rate of desertion?
Well, the only thing that came to my mind, most of them were, they weren't English, they were, came from Cyprus or Malta or somewhere, there were quite a big group of them, and they seemed to be, tried at different days and so on, it all went on quite a long time. And I can't remember exactly what the result was. They were convicted, but... I don't know quite what they would be. I presume they were sentenced to some imprisonment. But I can't remember any other offence which was sort of of any quantity.
When you were attached to the Egyptian army, what impression did you get of them?
Not very. But I don't think, they weren't really very heartily in the war at all. In fact, certainly I never heard it, but it was known that quite a few of the population carrier hoped the enemy was going to win. But I think my impression was that comfort was rather an important aspect. Then when it was suggested they should go out for a day's training in the desert, they didn't really like it very much. But the only thing I achieved there from them, which might have had some benefit later, I don't know, was that I got permission to take some of them down to an artillery training.